This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Two former Penn State administrators accused of trying to cover up that school's child sex abuse scandal will face trial and perjury charges. A judge made that decision at a preliminary hearing yesterday. One witness was the main focus of that proceeding. Assistant football coach Mike McQuarrie offered testimony with graphic detail about what he saw in a locker room more than 9 years ago. A word of caution: the following report contains language that may not be suitable for all audiences. Here's NPR's Jeff Brady.
Mike McQuarrie is easy to spot on the sidelines of Penn State football games. He's the one with bright red hair. Back in March of 2002, McQuarrie was a graduate assistant, dropping off some shoes at a locker room late in the evening. In a courtroom Friday, where recording was not allowed, McQuarrie testified that he encountered former assistant coach Jerry Sandusky in the shower with a boy about 10 or 12 years old. In McQuarrie's words, it appeared the two were having sex, but he says he couldn't be certain. McQuarrie says he slammed his locker door and went to the shower. By that time, he says, Sandusky and the boy had separated, and that Sandusky had a blank look on his face. In the hours and days that followed, he reported what he saw to his father, a family friend, then head coach Joe Paterno, athletic director Tim Curley, and university vice president Gary Schultz, who oversaw the campus police. But Curley and Schultz say McQuarrie told them Sandusky and the boy were just horsing around in a way that seemed inappropriate, though not sexual. Prosecutors believe Curley and Schultz are lying. The purpose of Friday's hearing was to determine if there's enough evidence to take the case to trial. The judge said there is.
I think nothing happened today that we from the defense team didn't expect.
Caroline Roberto is a lawyer for Curley. She told reporters immediately after the hearing that although the judge found prosecutors were able to meet their burden of proof,
which is very, very low at this hearing, they will never be able to reach their burden of proof at a trial where it is the highest standard known in American law beyond a reasonable doubt.
Widener University Law School professor Wes Oliver listened to the hearing and also predicts a trial will not go well for prosecutors.
It's my absolute expectation that there would be a not guilty verdict.
This is a case of McQuarrie's word against Curley and Schultz's, but Professor Oliver thinks the differences between the men are more about alternative characterizations of the same incident. Oliver says this was even clearer when Mike McQuarrie's father, John, testified.
John McQuarrie, to me, sounded like a defense witness. He characterized his son as having described inappropriate and potentially sexual activity in that shower. That is almost a carbon copy of the description that Schultz and Curley gave to the grand jury.
If a perjury charge doesn't stand, prosecutors are left with the other charge, failure to report an allegation of child sex abuse. And under Pennsylvania law, Oliver says the statute of limitations on that already has passed. Pennsylvania's senior deputy attorney general Mark Costanzo says what's most important in this case is that people who should have helped the alleged victims didn't.
I think it's a sad, sad, sad day when you think about all of these victims. And you just got your first taste of it today. And you saw the inaction by a number of very supposedly important, responsible adults.
Curley and Schultz are scheduled for a formal arraignment on January 19th. Meanwhile, Jerry Sandusky waived his right to a preliminary hearing, meaning his case already is headed to trial. And prosecutors say their investigation into child sex abuse allegations against him is continuing. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, more than 20 years ago, a couple of businessmen made an unusual investment. They set aside more than $300,000 to help dozens of kids pay for college who might not have had the chance to go otherwise. Now those kids are all grown up, and the Washington Post caught up with some of them to see where they are now. We'll follow up, too, in just a few minutes. But first, what exactly does a kid from a poor neighborhood need to succeed in life? Some may say better schools, more libraries, or safer streets. But journalist Gene Marks caused a stir recently with his post for Forbes.com titled, "If I Were a Poor Black Kid." He said as a poor black kid, he would study hard, use technology to get better grades, go to good schools, and learn a skill. Marks, you should note, is neither poor nor black nor a kid. He lets you know that in his article posted on Forbes magazine's website. In fact, he is a white, middle-aged business and technology writer. And in the article, he says many of these kids don't have the brains to figure this out themselves, like my kids, except that my kids are just lucky enough to have parents and a well-funded school system around to push them in the right direction. Technology can help these kids, but only if the kids want to be helped. Well, response to the article was fast and furious, mostly from other writers. One of them is Baratunde Thurston, who is co-founder of the blog Jack and Joe Politics, digital media director for the satirical publication The Onion, and author of the forthcoming book How to Be Black. He joined us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome, Baratunde. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me back. It's always a good time.
Well, thanks. But I do want to mention for those who are wondering why we're not talking to Gene Marks, we did call him. He did not respond, but he did respond to you eventually, and I want to hear about that. But as we mentioned, this article drew a lot of criticism. You are only one of the writers who wanted to weigh in. But what do you think it is that pushed all these people's buttons?
Well, first of all, I think if you really want to know what poor black kids need, it is for a admittedly disconnected middle-aged white guy to tell them what they need. And once they have that, they're fully empowered to take advantage of all the opportunities this great country has to offer.
And you are being tongue-in-cheek here, I do have to mention, which is kind of sums up how you reacted to this piece.
No, it is. I mean, there were a lot of legitimate reactions, sort of, when I say legitimate, I mean direct rebuttals to what Mr. Marks had to offer. There were other satirical takes, some great stories like, you know, if I were a middle-aged white guy, this is what I would do. And I think there are many elements of what was wrong with what he said that all of us were trying to focus on. The first is there's an admission of ignorance on Gene's part. Look, I'm not poor. I'm not black. I don't know what I'm talking about, but listen to me, kids. So that's already kind of a logical, you know, problem right there. The second is what you pointed out in the intro, that he goes through all these basic things that poor black kids need to do. He puts himself in their position and says, if I were poor, this is what I would do. And then says, but they probably can't do it anyway because they don't have the brains.
Well, one of the things that caught my attention is where he said that kids should use Skype to study with people, you know, so they can serve. And I thought to myself, exactly how is that supposed to work?
The unfortunate part is that there are core relevant elements to what he had to say. The delivery was completely condescending in a vacuum and disconnected from the reality. And the idea that you could list a bunch of websites and say, hey, kids, go use freecalculator.com, Skype, and Google Scholar, and you'll be set. It misses the actual way that people make progress in this society, that it's not just the kid's willpower and access to a few websites which propels you, you know, academically, socioeconomically, and politically, that there is a more group mentality, and it's the efforts of a group consciously and political change that help those things happen.
One of the things, though, I do want to go back to the question of why you think it got the reaction that it did, because you said in your own post that you initially wanted to ignore it. Because you felt that in part that this is part of a, I'll use this word, you didn't use it, but it's part of a scam, basically, increasingly on the blogosphere, that the whole point is to say something as outrageous as possible just so that people will respond, so that you increase your number of hits, and that just kind of gives the thing more of a life of its own. So initially you wanted to resist it, but you found that you could not. How come you couldn't? You just said you had to. Why did you finally respond?
There are, you know, people say dumb things on the internet all the time, and if, you know, those of us with slightly more intelligence engage that every single time, that's all we would do. Like, I'm trying to live my own life. I'm trying to have a positive existence in the world. So I don't want to spend all my time reacting to incendiary stupidity. So I think there was a part of self-preservation and kind of allocation of my own resources. I'm like, somebody else will deal with this, but it didn't die. And I think where it becomes a problem, not just that it was off-base and off-putting, but that the advice was so generic. It's generic advice that anyone should take, but is not practically applicable. But that people take it seriously, that it starts to affect the conversation, and it gives others an excuse to say, yeah, all poor black kids needs is a list of websites and some motivation from Gene Marks. And if they really wanted to improve their lives, they would want it more. His ultimate goal is like, here's some tools, and you need more willpower, right? You need to want to be poor less, and that will unlock the opportunities of this country for you. That is, at best, useless advice, but at worst, dangerous, because it sets up an expectation that, oh, the real reason people don't make it ahead in America is because they don't want to make it ahead enough.
So finally, Baratundi, that Jean Marx didn't get back to us. He did not respond to our many queries to him, but he did respond to you. What did he say in response to your piece? He did actually post directly to you. What did he say?
He did not respond in a way that changed or acknowledged what I said. He said he was a big fan of The Onion, which is always nice to hear. I think everyone should be. But he basically restated his case. He's like, I heard what you said, but here's what I say in response. Read my first column. And it was a bulleted list of, if I were a poor black kid, I would study harder, get better grades, use technology to improve those grades, go into a better school, and pick up a skill. And it's like, okay, here, so we're back at square one or square zero.
Well, you don't disagree with studying hard.
I don't disagree. Again, I was a poor black kid, right? And so there's a very personal element to this as well for me, which is I grew up in D.C., and I didn't have a ton of resources. I wasn't destitute. We always had food and clothing and a decent shelter. But I was able to make progress because my mom was very involved, because there were community resources. I'm not talking big government spending. I'm talking about the Boy Scouts that I was a part of, the D.C. Youth Orchestra program that I was a part of, Higher Achievement Program, which is an academic sort of booster network. And it wasn't just my willpower that allowed for my own story. It was the will and effort of the community around me, which had the resources to invest in me collectively. Okay. And what Gene ignores, and so his advice is useless, he just says, oh, visit this website, be smarter, be better. The best reaction I got from, and we set up this website, poorblackkid.com.
Okay, Barton, very briefly.
Yeah, we set up a website, poorblackkid.com, to kind of continue this dialogue. And someone said, oh, if you're, you know, letter to the children of Darfur, A, don't be killed. B, start small businesses. And it's just like, okay, starting a small business is great advice, but it misses the point that it's not necessarily a leap you go to from being a child of Darfur to do that. It's not a leap you go to from just being a poor black kid to suddenly decide, I'm going to use all these great tools and better myself. It's much more complicated. And ultimately, he did a disservice to the challenge by oversimplifying it.
Baratunde Thurston is co-founder of the blog Jack and Jill Politics. He's director of digital media for The Onion and author of the forthcoming book, How to Be Black. And he joined us from our bureau in New York. Baratunde, thank you.
As always, a great time. Thank you.
And now we'd like to talk about two white guys who did more than just talk about poor black kids, but actually did something to help them. Back in the spring of 1988, 59 students at an elementary school just outside of Washington, D.C., gathered with their parents for an announcement that would change their lives. Two local philanthropists made a pledge to set aside more than $300,000 so that the fifth graders at Seat Pleasant Elementary School could go to college, all of them. Abe Poland, the owner of the then Washington Bullets, now the Wizards, and the Washington Capitals, and businessman Melvin Cohen, came to the school located in a struggling neighborhood to make the promise in person. Parents and students were dumbfounded. Some clapped, some cheered, some thanked God. Now those students at Seat Pleasant are in their 30s. Their lives have taken some interesting turns. The Washington Post's Paul Schwartzman has written about the students' journey from that afternoon in 1988 to now, and he's with us now. Also with us, Jeffrey Norris, one of the Seat Pleasant 59. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Jeffrey, I just have to ask you, when you walked into that auditorium that day and you heard this, what'd you think? Do you remember?
Slightly. It was a lot of chaos to the point that of misunderstanding because, you know, when you're coming from what they call quote-unquote struggling neighborhood, it wasn't that much talk about, you know, college, you know, and for that, you know, we knew more about the I Have a Dream, Martin Luther King speech than we knew about what was happening on that day when Abe Poland and Melvin Cohen came.
So
to
it was kind of like this abstract idea, like we're going to go to college. So what does that mean? Is it, was it more like that? I mean, you saw the adults reacting. So,
yes, yes.
And crying. And so you figured it must be something, but you weren't even really sure.
Yes,
what that meant.
I wasn't really, really sure at the time. You know, it was clueless to me until, you know, you get to, you get further on in life, you know, you start to realize, you know, what was the importance of that day, you know, and unfortunately that it took a little longer, but some of us grasped it others faster than others, you know, but, you know, it's like I said, through time and strength, you know, you still valued what came through the I Have a Dream Foundation.
Paul, pick up the story there, if you would. It's a very interesting story, by the way. It's still unfolding in the pages of the Post right now. Was there a one of the through lines was it wasn't enough to just pay the money. It wasn't enough just to say, here's this money, right?
Right.
And how quickly did people realize that it wasn't enough to just say, here's this money?
Well, because, I mean, not every family, families didn't have a lot of experience with college. So there was sort of a standard was being imposed that they weren't necessarily going to gravitate towards. And I think that it just took a lot of time for the thing to evolve. And the kids, you know, developed their own interests. And so in the end, a lot of them didn't want to go to college. I mean, they went to college and it didn't work out. They really wanted to work with their hands. They wanted to be elevator repairmen or car mechanics. Or one guy ended up as a UPS driver, and that's what made sense for him. And but this idea that they should be in college was sort of instilled in them, and that's what they have to live with. That's where it becomes sort of a burden because a standard was imposed that they aren't necessarily comfortable with. And so what was interesting for me is that it sort of redefined the idea of success. What is success? What does it mean to be successful in life? And I came away with thinking that it's not necessarily to get a college diploma. You can do a lot of different things with your life, and it can work out, and you can be, you know, it can be happy.
Jeffrey, what about you? Your life took some turns.
Yes,
some
ma'am.
Turns. Started out rough.
Yes,
I mean,
ma'am.
You witnessed your uncle getting beaten to death when you were just 8 years old. That has to be traumatic. My children are eight, and I
yes,
mean,
ma'am.
Just the idea of having them see something like that just makes me want to cry.
Yes, ma'am.
And then you wound up having some problems with the law yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Before your sentencing hearing, you were involved in an accident, badly injured. The judge decided to give you a break. He gave you a break, right? I mean, that's
yes,
the
ma'am.
Way
she
to,
did.
She
yes,
gave
ma'am.
You a break.
Mm-hmm.
And then something turned for you after that. What do you think it was?
I believe, you know, I'm spiritual based. So, you know, I believe that It was a time for change, and you know, through facing 25 years to life on the charge, I got in two months before I got to sentencing. I had a flip on 50 going home.
Route 50. It's a
yes,
route.
Ma'am. Route
yeah.
50.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
So it was tragic to the point that after that event, and you know, when you dealing with the streets, you know, you start thinking first and foremost that I don't want to get locked up with a wound. See, you have to, you know, you're still dealing with what you have to deal with in the streets. And I didn't want to go in, so you're an easy target. So you could have been easily taken out, you know. So it's all that's going through your mind. You're going, you don't never know how many years you're going to be doing. And then, you know, and then on top of that, you get amity, you know, and you have to look at it like it's a higher power somewhere, you know, it's something, it's an intervention somewhere, not only with, you know, TV shows, but.
I hear
but,
you.
Yes, you know.
So
but,
so now you are a barber,
yes,
and you
ma'am.
Look very nice, too, by the way.
Yes,
I say your hair is looking sharp, so you must
Thank
know what
you.
You're doing.
Yes, ma'am.
And you're a minister of music, and Paul raised this whole question of, you know, success. Do you feel you found it?
I believe I've reached spiritual success, meaning sometimes you have to be grounded with things that is sometimes not explainable, and it's things that we do on a daily basis that comes out to understand that, you know, it's a walk, it's an everyday daily process, and if you don't, you know, if you don't keep your eyes open, keep your mind open, a lot of things could be more impacted to you than you would never, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Sometimes you won't be able to, you know what I'm saying, come back on.
I hear
yes.
you.
What I love
so,
about,
Paul, final thought from you, yeah.
What I love about what Jeffrey sort of articulates for all the dreamers is that the story's still being written. And it's really unfolding, and it doesn't end when you're 22. It just goes on and on.
Well, I credit you, but Paul, I did want to ask, since you did kind of pick up the story here, and I must say it's a fascinating and complex story, and I'm excited to read it because I actually remember it. I'm dating myself, but I remember when the announcement was made. What do you think was the do you think the gift made a difference? And was there any through line that you could find in for whom, which kids it really did make a difference for?
I think it really made a difference for all of them. There were certain kids that were going to do great anyway, but I think an idea was planted in them that maybe they couldn't execute, but they will pass down to their children because they now have this idea of what life can be. And so if they didn't get through college or they didn't go to college, they're going to see that their kids go to college or they're going to put that kind of standard on them. And I think that should be positive.
I did see, did note from the piece that, that the girls as a group seem to do better in terms of the original intent, which is going to college. Is that true? And why is that?
Having a daughter myself, I'm sort of getting the idea that girls generally do better in school.
Okay. All right. To be continued, as you told us, the story continues. Paul Schwartzman has written a series looking at some of the 59 students who received scholarships from businessman and philanthropist Abe Poland back in 1988. Those stories are now in the Washington Post, and you can read them online. Jeffrey Norris is one of the Seat Pleasant 59. He is now a barber who is working on setting up his own shop. He is also, and good luck with that.
Thank you.
And he's also a minister of music at his church, and they were both kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Gentlemen, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, if it's a little music you need to get you into the holiday spirit, then you may want to freshen some of those tried and true Christmas carols with jazz.
What we always want to do is communicate emotion and feeling through our technical prowess and musicianship.
Musician Marcus Roberts spices up some of our favorite Christmas tunes. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.